Today on Stories Unbound, interview with Scholastic editor Orly Zurawicki. Welcome to Stories Unbound, your guide to the growing world of kid lit and children's book publishing. I'm Shauna J.C. Tenney. I'm an author and an illustrator. My story went from personal project to published book, and I want to help you do the same in an ever-changing industry. Welcome to Stories Unbound. I hope you're having a lovely spring. That is, if you live on the northern hemisphere. I'm having a lovely spring. Today I just planted onions and carrots and peas. And as I was planting them, I was thinking, you know, this is a lot like having an illustration career or having a writing career. You send a lot of stuff out on the internet. You send stuff to editors, agents. You're always planting those seeds. Sometimes those seeds don't grow. Sometimes my carrot seeds don't grow and I have to replant them. But nothing's gonna grow if you don't plant those seeds. So just keep planting seeds and something is bound to grow. So today on Stories Unbound, I interviewed Orly Zurawicki, who is the senior editor at Scholastic and also the author of the forthcoming Happily Ever Afterlife middle grade novel series. Here's what we talk about in the interview. How an editor chooses an illustrator, how to approach an editor at a conference, how being an editor helped Orly become a better writer, why manuscript submissions get rejected, and why there are more opportunities in the kidlit industry now than ever before. Now, before we jump into the interview with Orly, here's a quick promotion about a course at the Oatly Academy. Whether you write children's books, screenplays, or novels, draw storyboards or comics, you are a storyteller. And every storyteller understands that turning our lofty thoughts into a finished work often feels like an uphill climb. The Storyteller Summit, an online course at the Oatly Academy, will provide guidance from some of the entertainment industry's best teachers. We'll help you master fundamental concepts like developing your protagonist, building a believable world, constructing a compelling plot, finding your voice, and fighting writer's block. And since stories are meant for others to enjoy, we'll also show you how to grow your audience online. Subscribe to the Storyteller Summit today and get instant access to our extensive and growing library of video lessons, our supportive community forums, downloadable worksheets, monthly Oatly Academy live sessions, and story groups that meet throughout the month where you can ask questions, share ideas, geek out about story, and find a great circle of trust. Your story is waiting. Sign up for the Storyteller Summit at oatlyacademy.com/go/SU Summit. You might also like to know that if you enroll today with that link, I'll get a small commission, which will go to support my career and my family. And again, that's oatlyacademy.com/go/SU as in Stories Unbound Summit. Welcome. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Yeah. I thought we would start out and get a little bit of an introduction to you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and exactly how you became an editor at Scholastic?
Yes, absolutely. So I grew up in upstate New York in Albany, and I came to New York City for college. I went to Barnard up by Columbia.
Okay.
And I double majored in English and psychology. Hmm. Actually, when I came to college, I sort of had this vision that I was going to be a psychologist. That was my plan.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I think after about a year and a half of classes, I was super bored. And I just realized this is not going to work for me. And so I started taking some English classes. Actually, it was my father who suggested that I maybe think about it. And I got hooked. But I ended up double majoring, which, you know, has been useful.
Yeah.
The summer of my sophomore year, I interned at a small publishing house in the city. It was like a small educational house focusing on children's. And I loved it. I had a great time. I actually continued on through the year interning when I, you know, on some days that I could make it work with my schedule. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated, the first job I got was in publishing at that house. And my first job was actually a fact checker. So it was a great first job. I had a lot of autonomy. I learned a lot. And I was there for about 3 years. I eventually got promoted. And so when I left, I was doing editorial work there. But then I took a job at Simon & Schuster in a very different field of publishing. So it was all fiction and actually a lot of license-based work that I was doing at Simon. And I was there for, I think, a little over 6 years, maybe. And then I came over to Scholastic.
Okay.
And now I'm currently a senior editor at Scholastic, and I acquire fiction and nonfiction for basically ages like 0 to 7, 8.
Oh, okay. And you're probably good at the nonfiction since you were a fact checker.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating how it all comes full circle. So much for the last, gosh, you know, 7 years or so, I haven't had to deal with it at all. And now in sort of dealing with nonfiction again, which is somewhat new to my role, I have to sort of refocus and remember. And yeah, we've actually been having a lot of conversations with the production department about fact checking and how to sort of refine that process and how important it is.
Yeah. Now, jumping back, because you said your dad kind of encouraged you to do the English. What did he see in your growing up years that kind of helped him push you towards that?
Well, you know, I don't know that it was so much about me specifically in terms of things I showed him growing up, other than just being his real love of literature and learning. My father is a huge reader. I mean, he has read so many books, thousands and thousands of books. And he's just constantly reading. So, you know, it's a huge, huge passion for him. So I think he wanted all of us to have it. I'm actually one of four girls in my family, three sisters. So he encouraged all of us to do that. But, you know, I think that I obviously picked up on it in a little bit of a different way than my sisters did. So I'm sure he saw that in me. But there's actually a really funny story that I think about a lot and I tell with regard to sort of my entry into writing and my dad, which is that when I was writing my college essay, we had this big sort of fight about it because it was the first time I had done some creative writing in high school and, you know, I did enjoy English and literature and all that, but it was sort of the first time I think I like stood my ground on something. And even if I didn't really realize what it was leading to, it was a big moment, I think, for me in my writing because I wrote my college essay. I think that the question was something about like, what's your favorite place or what's a sacred place for you? Something along those lines. And I wrote this essay about my car, essentially. And it sounds so silly. I mean, it really does, but it wasn't a silly essay. It was a very serious, you know, sort of, I like to think lyrically written essay. And so he was like red penning it and wanted me to change all of these things. And I felt so passionately about them and I would not let him. I was like, no. It was the first time I really sort of stood up to him and I said, it's just not going to happen. I'm not going to change it. That's not what I want to say. And, you know, I remember like fighting about it and, you know, in the end, of course I got in and I actually, you know, received some pretty high praise for it. And it was kind of that funny moment where you're like, yeah, this is a thing. Like, I think this is something I can do, but he's always been a huge fan. He's always, you know, he's always been encouraging that love of English and that sort of side of things. So, you know, when I was in, I would say like middle school, elementary, middle school, he was always encouraging me with regard to what I should read. And like, if I had a book report coming up, I would always say to him, all right, I have to do a book report. What should I read? And he would hand me The Picture of Dorian Gray, you know?
Nice. So, so he really encourage the deep reading.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And speaking of your writing, you've written a lot of books. I don't know where I read it, but it said you've written over 100 books, which I was very impressed by.
I don't want to bring it down in any way because it is a lot of work, but I will say that a large percentage of those books are license-based properties. And, you know, that's a really fascinating kind of writing in and of itself. You know, it's very different from this sort of original trade-based publishing because you are working from a platform of something that exists already. You're writing, you know, something based on characters that exist in a movie or a TV show or a property. So writing to guidelines, it's not something that you are dreaming up in your head necessarily, you know, from scratch. But it's a really fascinating and creative form of writing because, you know, you have to figure out how to be creative within that box. And that's a challenge, and not everyone can do that. So, and you also need to be able to craft your writing to a particular voice. And so in a sense, there's a similarity there with any type of writing, because if you're writing from a character perspective, you know, obviously you need to be able to do that as well.
Right.
But here, you know, it's not a voice that's it's not coming from within you. It's not this like passion thing you've dreamed. It's somebody has written this character. It's somebody else's voice, and you need to embody it, and you need to do that well. And there, again, lots of guidelines with regard to what you can and can't do and say. And also when you're talking about writing for children, you have a very limited space and a limited number of characters that you can write in, you know? So,
right.
So there's a lot of boxes to check when you're doing that. And so I've done a lot of licensed writing, and that's, I think, where that number of over 100 has come from. There've been a lot of novelty books, a lot of 8x8s, a lot of movie tie-ins, a lot of that. I love it. I really enjoy it. I think it's a lot of fun.
Nice. I was looking at your website, and you have written a series of books called Happily Ever Afterlife.
I have.
It looks very cool.
Thank you. I'm so excited about it. So, like I said, I spent a lot of time doing licensed work, and I think for about 10 years or so, that was sort of just where I stayed in terms of the type of writing I did. Although I did some of my own stuff, but I wasn't really dedicated to sort of getting it out there in the industry until relatively recently. So I'd say about 3 years ago, I really started to think, hey, this is something I want to do, and I want to start getting out there and seeing how my work is accepted, if it's accepted.
Yeah.
And so that's where Happily Ever Afterlife kind of came to life. And I'm so excited about it. It's a middle grade series that Scholastic is actually publishing, and it comes out in the summertime.
Oh.
About a character named Lucy, who is a 6th grade girl who wakes up one day and realizes that she's a ghost, and she just kind of has to navigate this new life in this new world of limbo. And it handles a lot of your classic sort of a middle school drama and the issues, crushes, like being a new kid. But I would like to think that it takes a little bit of a deeper dive into those subjects. I don't take it lightly at all. I think middle school can be really tricky. You deal with a lot of issues when you're that age,
and
I certainly did. And so that's what I keep in mind when I write the books. And I try to sort of see everything from every character's perspective. And, you know, there's a mean girl, but she's not just a mean girl, because mean girls aren't two dimensional. You know, there's a reason why that's happening.
Right,
so
right.
I try to look at everything from that perspective. And then of course there's also this really fun sort of ghostly twist to it, which just kind of keeps things interesting and makes things a little bit harder in a funny way.
It sounds exactly like something my girls would love to read, because they're in that age range. And being published by Scholastic, how does the editing process work with that, since you're working at Scholastic?
So I work, as I said, on books ages 0 to 8.
Okay.
And this basically falls in that range right above that, which is that middle grade 8 to 12 range. So it doesn't fall into my publisher's purview. So it's being published by the paperback division, and they have a different publisher, a different editorial director. And I also have an editor. So I work essentially the same way that anyone would work if they published a book with Scholastic. I get feedback on certain things. I'm allowed feedback on certain things, just in the same way that I would send, you know, a cover sketch to an author of mine and say, hey, we got this in. What do you think? You know, what do you have any feedback? It's really very, very similar.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's helpful that you get the very same kind of help. It's not like some weird thing where you have to do it yourself, because every book should really be a group effort, even if it's a personal
absolutely.
Book. For sure.
Yeah. Every book is, it takes a village.
Right.
It really does. So yeah, it's certainly like that. And, you know, of course, like you said, it's nice to have a little bit of guidance, even though I've been in this industry for what, like 15 years or something like that. This is the first time I'm doing my own middle grade series. So there's some things I don't know.
Right.
And, you know, there's some things I do, a lot of things I do know because I have that other sort of insider information, if you will, because of what I do. So, you know, that's obviously very, very helpful for me. But there are still some things that, you know, I'm like, I'm a newbie at, and I need to sort of check in with my editor and say, hey, how does this work? How should I move forward with this? Mm-hmm. So yeah, she's there for me whenever I need her.
What are some ways that being an editor has helped you in writing your own books?
Wow. So many ways, I think. And the flip side of that too, is that writing has helped me, I think, become a better editor. Mm. So, you know, I think going back to sort of what I talked about a little while ago with regard to the licensed writing, doing a lot of those types of projects early on in my writing career, I would say, really helped me understand how to craft a good story, how to keep the plot moving. You know, there's so much that happens in these, either if it's a TV show or it's a movie, and you need to like truncate it, you need to squeeze it into like one 24 page 8x8 or 32 page 8x8, whatever that format is. And you need to figure out how to hit the right notes. Very, very early on when I first started writing, which was, I actually started my own, writing on my own when I first graduated from college, but I didn't do anything with what I was writing. But I remember sending that early on a portion of that to an agent, and hearing back, the feedback was, wow, this is great writing. It's extremely polished. You know, all of these positive things about the writing itself, but there's nothing happening. It's all in the character's head and there's nothing happening.
Right.
And I'm getting bored. And so it was a struggle for me early on to figure out how to keep that plot moving forward and how to show and not tell. And so, you know, I think doing all of that licensed writing really helped me with that aspect that I was struggling with. And so now that's a huge part of what I look for when I'm reviewing manuscripts as an editor, is what's happening? Is there enough happening? Is something happening? Is there a trajectory of this story arc, right? Are we leading up to a conflict? Do we have a resolution? Does it feel satisfying? All of those questions that I ask every time I read a manuscript. So I always attribute a large portion of that understanding at this point in my editorial career to sort of what I went through trying to filter it into my own writing, you know, which was a struggle for me.
Let's talk a little bit about what you do as an editor. First of all, what imprints are you over at Scholastic?
I am currently a senior editor, and I specialize in acquiring fiction and nonfiction, as I said, for ages like 0 to 8. Mm-hmm. And I acquire for Cartwheel Books, which is Scholastic's youngest imprint. That's Board Books and Novelty, Scholastic Press, Orchard Books, and our nonfiction, which is sort of not a specific imprint name. It kind of depends on, you know, what the format is exactly. If it's a picture book, it will generally go under either Scholastic Press or Orchard, depending on what type of nonfiction picture book it is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, also readers are sort of classified under that just general Scholastic umbrella. And again, like some of the nonfiction paperback series will do, or even just any format series that are for the older ages, like 6 to 8, will generally be classified as just Scholastic in general.
Okay. So Scholastic is, they don't do unsolicited manuscripts, right?
That's correct.
So you mostly get things from agents. Do agents generally know which imprint to send the stuff to, do you think?
Or is it that's a fascinating question. I think in general, probably the answer to that question is no.
Huh.
Although I think there are some agents who are familiar with the different imprints and what they do, and they have a lot of agents have existing relationships with different editors, you know, across Scholastic. Mm. So they sort of are familiar with what that particular editor does versus what another editor does, or like what may fall under one imprint that wouldn't necessarily fall under another. You know, I think right now we're not quite as transparent as we could be about who does what, and we're always working toward that goal and trying to make that clearer. But of course, anyone who contacts me with a project that isn't quite right for me, I always pass it along to someone who it might be right for. So we're very good at Scholastic about getting things to the right people if they don't arrive there originally.
Okay, that's good. I'm sure a lot of people don't know how that kind of works internally. So besides maybe passing things on to other editors, is there other ways in which you work with the editors at Scholastic?
Definitely. I mean, my department is extremely close and we work together very, very creatively. I personally think it's a challenge to sit in your office and work in a vacuum as an editor. I need a perspective from other people. I need to hear people's reactions to manuscripts. I mean, of course, I have a gut reaction to things when I read them, but it's always really helpful for me to listen to other points of view and hear how somebody else may have reacted to something, or if their vision for what this book could be is totally different from my vision. That's great. A lot of times we align, which is also great because it means you hit on something, you know, your gut reaction told you something that is resonating because everyone else has had that same reaction. Mm-hmm. Particularly in Cartwheel, which again is our board book novelty youngest area of publishing, we're extremely collaborative. It's almost impossible to be successful in that really tricky market without having a lot of people by your side, sort of.
Yeah.
Again, this whole it takes a village idea.
Right.
It's very, very true.
For sure. In any part of publishing. It's such a group effort, I think.
Yes.
Even from the writer, taking it to your critique group, it's just always such a collaborative process, I think.
It really is. It's because it's so easy to get stuck in your head and you sort of spiral right down this black hole, if you will. If you're alone too much, you lose perspective. So you have to open up to that wider perspective of other people who are right there with you.
Yeah, for sure. If you are given a full dummy book as an editor, how much of a process do you have in the artwork part of things?
For this young age, this, you know, 0 to 7 age range, mm-hmm. the art and text are so, so connected that as an editor, I'm very involved in what style that artwork should be and what that artwork should say. And so I work really, really closely with my art director and my designers on every project. It is a collective decision, you know, who we're going to go for if we're hiring an artist or if we're looking for, you know, someone to bring a manuscript to life. Mm-hmm. But on the editorial side, you know, I think we do a lot of that discovery work as well. It's not just happening in the art department. You know, I'm looking online, I'm looking at agent websites, I'm looking through lookbooks, and I'm bringing that short list of people who I have in my mind to the table, and then I'm sending that out to the, you know, my editorial director, my publisher, my art director. Hey, here's who I think might do a great job on this project. What do you think? And then they'll throw names out too, or they'll say that person's amazing. Yes, let's do that. You know, but I would say like probably 95% of the time when I go into an acquisitions meeting, I'm bringing the manuscript attached with an artist. And that's not always the same person, right? So if I just am acquiring a text, I'm still bringing it in with an illustrator in mind.
So do you, as an editor, get a lot of postcards or email blasts directly from illustrators?
I don't get as many emails directly from illustrators, but I do get postcards. And I enjoy postcards. I don't think that they are my go-to when I'm looking for something. I mean, I do have a little stack of people I keep, but to be completely honest, I can't remember the last time I went searching through it for someone, you know, like so much of it happens online for me. So, but the one thing I will say with regard to like something physical to look through is I do like booklets and like the Society of Illustrators Original Art Show, when they do that booklet every year. I mean, obviously those are artists who have gotten into the show. And so, you know, but still it's a really helpful tool when I'm looking for an illustrator for a picture book manuscript. I can go through that collection and just kind of, it jogs my memory about people. But even if you're just an illustrator looking to do something different, I think I would suggest maybe doing a small like lookbook of your work. And maybe, you know, if money is a factor, sending it to a shorter list of people, like don't just blast it out to thousands of people, you know, like do your research, figure out what list you really want to be on, who you would really love to connect with, whose work you like, and do something that's going to stand out a little bit more. And I have in the past gotten some things like that. And those are definitely things that I've kept and they make an impression.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach that I'm sure a lot of artists haven't thought of. When you're looking online, do you tend to look more at artist representatives for illustrators, or do you ever look on just individual artists' Instagrams? What things are you more drawn to online, do you think?
You know, I look at both. I mean, obviously, when I'm looking for an illustrator for a particular manuscript, my first go-to is going to agent sites of agencies who I know are representing a certain caliber of artists that, you know, I think would be a good fit for the project. But that's not the only place I look. I certainly love finding new people on Instagram. I think I've actually signed up one artist from some kind of social media area, and that was actually someone I found on Behance. Hmm. So I definitely like to look around at different sites. And there are some that I think have a really great caliber of artists on them. But definitely, you know, the agent websites are my first go-to if I have a specific project in mind.
Nice. Let's talk a little bit more about getting connected with authors. Great way to get connected with authors is conferences, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So at conferences, what do you think are some things that authors should or should not expect when meeting an editor in person?
Good question. So I think the first thing that you should think about if you're going to a conference and if you're wanting to sort of approach an editor, but you're feeling nervous or whatever, is really just that they are regular people just like you and just want to have a good conversation. You know, I think we're there because we want some exposure and we do want to connect with new people. We want to meet new authors. We want, you know, we're always looking for new talent and new voices. And we also want to help you. Mm-hmm. So if you're meeting someone new, just try to make some small talk and get to know them a little bit before you sort of launch into these bigger picture questions, which I know, you know, everyone goes to a conference because they want that FaceTime, they want that personal interaction, and they do have questions that they want to ask. And that's totally fine. We understand that when we go to conferences that that's what's going to happen. But I do think it's important to break the ice first a little. And then you can always circle back around. You know, when you go to a conference, you generally have at least 2 days where everyone is in one place. And so I think that's a great sort of thing to keep in mind. Also, if you're going to a conference, one thing that you shouldn't be holding out for is that you're going to pitch something and the editor is immediately going to say to you, yes, I want this. I want to publish this. This is amazing. I think that there are, and not that many people do that, but I think there are some first-time conference goers that maybe have that in their mind that might happen.
Right.
So, you know, I, again, talking about how things take a village and how, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into making something perfect. Nothing is perfect when you first pitch it. So even if it is the best first pitch I've ever seen, it's still going to need to go through the process. So I think it's important to just think of conferences as a place to connect, to make that first initial face-to-face connection if it's someone who's brand new to you, and to get a sense for what they're looking for. Because even though you've maybe spent the last 6 months or however long sort of refining this one particular project that you're really, really excited about, it doesn't mean that that project is going to be right for the editors you're meeting at that particular conference, right? Like, again, every editor is sort of crafting her own list based on, or his or her own list, based on what they want to put out there into the world, what, you know, what sort of passions are important for them, what they think the list needs, et cetera, and all these factors. So mm-hmm. I do think it's important to use that time to get to know the editor and get to know her list and what she wants, and then go back and think about what it is you might be able to send her way.
What are some of your personal favorite things about going to conferences?
You know, I think it's great to see all the enthusiasm at these conferences. People are so, so excited about children's books. Everyone is there because they want to be there. We all have busy lives. A lot of the authors and the illustrators I meet there are they work full time and they're parents and they're doing this because they love it. You know, they're squeezing it into their busy schedules and it's that's fantastic. I always love that kind of that energy, you know, that I feel at a conference, and I come back and I feel like, wow, this is, it's so nice to know that there are so many people out there who are just jazzed about this. Mm-hmm. That's great. And of course, it's awesome to go somewhere new and meet new people and then come back with potential new people that you could see on the list. I think that's always fantastic.
Yeah. When you go to conferences, I know that publishers often let people send in unsolicited things for a certain amount of time. Do you generally do things like that when you go? Or
I do. So what I haven't said in the past, but I think I might have to say moving forward, and this is, you know, possibly a good tip for some people listening, is that if you are going to send something to an editor after a conference, send one thing. Don't send 2, 3, 4, 5. Just have the opportunity to do that. You know, it's a challenge to make it through my pile of submissions to begin with outside of conference submissions.
Right.
I try to do my best to stay on top of it, but it's sort of ever growing. So that's its own challenge. And when you allow the unsolicited submissions after a conference, I think it's a really nice thing to do because, you know, a lot of the people who go to these conferences do not have agents and they're just looking for this feedback. I like being able to offer it, but I also will say that it's time consuming. So, you know, I think that if you are going to submit something, you need to think really, really carefully about what that is. And you should only really submit one thing.
Good advice. I'm sure that gets overwhelming. Let's talk a little bit about the children's publishing market right now. It seems to be doing very well. And with it doing very well, are you getting a lot more authors and illustrators submitting their work now?
Yeah, I guess I would say that submissions have gone up for me. I think I probably get on average between 2 and 5 agented submissions a day, give or take. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are breaking into the market now and it's definitely an exciting time, but I do think that the contributor category is growing.
And with so many new contributors, do you think the industry, at least as far as you can see it, with where you work at Scholastic, do you think new opportunities are being opened up to accommodate, or do you think it's sort of being oversaturated?
I don't think we're oversaturated. And I definitely think that opportunities are opening. I think we're seeing a big focus on this early education category right now, and it's coming from a lot of different areas. And I think we're even seeing that in bookstores as well. We're seeing a lot more space being opened up and devoted to the children's category. You know, I think even if you went into, say, Target and you looked around at the book section, I think you would be surprised to see what it looks like now as opposed to what it looked like, you know, say 5 years ago.
Right.
And I think we're seeing that all across the market, whether it's, you know, in the retail stores like Barnes & Noble or in those mass stores. Obviously, our brick and mortar bookstores have been doing that for years and years. But I think it's something that's permeating our consciousness even more. And so for sure, I think there's a lot more opportunity because I think people are starting to finally realize, hey, this is so important.
Yeah.
And even particularly in the young category, you know, I think obviously we saw a huge boom in the YA category, say 6, 7 years ago. Hmm. And, you know, when we started seeing a lot of crossover with adults reading YA. And so that was great, but that was particular to the older children's market. And now we're seeing that trickle down. So people are realizing, hey, this early category is really, really important. And of course, what we say at Scholastic, right, is that the love of reading starts on day one. And it's so important at that, even at that zero age. And people laugh at that, right? When I say, oh, Cartwheel publishes from 0 to 5. And it's like, what's zero? Well, zero is, of course, you know, still in the belly. And, you know, you should be reading at that point too. But of course, day one, the second the child comes out, that's when reading starts. And, you know, so I think it's nice that we're seeing people outside of the traditional sort of publishing market realizing, hey, this is a really important category. Early education is our future. It's the future success of our children.
It's exciting that it's doing so well. I'm very happy about that.
I am too.
Not only for working in the industry, just for the children and that they're getting more of it. That's exciting. As far as content in picture books, kind of from what you have seen come in and stuff, what sort of things do you think there's too much of in stories right now? And maybe what are some things that you would like to see more of?
That's an interesting question. I'm not entirely sure that off the top of my head, I feel there's specifically too much of anything of one particular subject. We do see this sort of collective consciousness of ideas that comes through, right? So if I receive, let's say, a book about pirates, a submission about pirates, and then a week later, a colleague of mine is like, oh yeah, I got this submission about pirates. And then we all talk about it. It's like, we've all received something from someone totally different about pirates. And
it's so funny.
And for some reason, we're like, okay, something's in the air with pirates. We've seen that in a lot of different categories. I mean, pirates certainly is one of them. I think we saw that with ninjas. We also have seen with animals, like animals being trendy. Owls were a huge trend. So, you know, it comes and it goes. And so I think sometimes when you hear someone say, I think we're a bit saturated with that subject right now, it doesn't mean that subject is over necessarily. It just means there's only so many picture books about, right, of pirates or owls that you can have in given time. And maybe that'll cycle out and then cycle back in again.
Yeah.
So there have definitely been phases where I've seen that happen. And you know, so in my mind, I've said, well, I think I'm done with that subject for right now. I've seen a lot of, or, you know, monsters was another one. There's always a lot. So anyway, but with regard to sort of what's kind of new and what I'd love to see more of is, you know, I think right now we're seeing a big opening in the market for innovative nonfiction in the picture book space. That's sort of having a moment. And, you know, I think we saw this surge in the fiction picture book space not too long ago, where there was sort of this new focus on the picture book and how sort of sophisticated and creative it can be. And so I think that's happening now with nonfiction, where people are realizing, hey, this is a great tool to teach some really important subjects, but they're doing it in a little bit of a different way now than they were, you know, or have been for the last 10 years. So I'm really excited about that. I think exciting things have happened and some more exciting things are going to happen.
Yeah, I've definitely seen some awesome nonfiction picture books come through. Like, I'm particularly thinking of the Caldecott winner from last year.
Finding Winnie.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fantastic book.
Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly what, you know, I'm sort of thinking about and focusing on. And I think that for a while, nonfiction has been seen as this category that requires a level of sophistication that is, with regard to the text and how things are explained, that is different from what would be required of a fiction picture book. And so the word count is always a lot larger. And, you know, so we're... You would see, I guess, a general fiction picture book nowadays is, I would say, at most 600 words. Some are even shorter than that, you know, but whatever, 500 to 600 words. And, you know, I get nonfiction submissions that are upwards of 1,000 or 2,000 words. And, you know, I think my sort of litmus test is that you're producing this product for the same age child.
Yeah.
Just because it's a nonfiction subject doesn't mean that the rules are different, right? Because you're still requiring a five-year-old, essentially, five to six, to sit down and read this book and be excited by it and to get information from it and to want to turn the pages, you know? So, so I think that's been really fascinating for me in this last year to see what submissions are coming in and how people are thinking about nonfiction and to really try and guide that when I give feedback to say, you need to think about a five-year-old listening to the story. It's the same as a fiction. I mean, you're trying to fit true information in this book. So that's a difference, of course, from fiction, but you're still, you know, you still need to send a message and you need to do it the same way that you would do it in fiction because all of that will still apply, right?
Yeah. I'm sure it's a big challenge. Trying to get all that information and tell a picture book story.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Absolutely.
All right. Before we wrap up, what advice would you give to author illustrators who have been submitting their work a lot and maybe have been getting rejections a lot?
Great question. And we talked about this a little bit in some of the other questions that we touched upon. But the absolute first thing I think anyone author, illustrator who, you know, who's trying to break into the market should do is seek outside help. So we talked about joining a writing group, right? Critique groups are so, so important. I'm in one myself as a writer. I think it's really important to get that feedback. And, you know, you want to find a group that is going to be a little hard on you. you don't want to hear, that's amazing, great, perfect, you're done.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice to hear that, of course. And if you're on revision number 120, sure, that's great. But if it's your first time out the gate with something and you're, you know, that means they're not digging deeply enough. So you do want to hear that feedback. It's important to have, and it'll go a long way in making your work as good as it can be. And it'll also help build your skin a little. You know, I think the second thing I would say is that you're definitely going to get rejected, and you're going to keep getting rejected because everyone gets rejected. And it's a really subjective field in a sense. I mean, there are some sort of guidelines you can go by. And again, we talked about some of those things, but you know, that there are absolutely things you can learn about the industry and where it's going and subjects that are more successful than others. But when you're submitting something, you're submitting it to a specific editor who has specific likes and dislikes and tastes, and they're building their list based on all of those likes and dislikes. And so it's very possible that whatever you've submitted just doesn't fit that criteria for them. There are also a lot of factors that go into whether or not something can be successful on a list. An editor can love something and ultimately realize it's just not going to find a home at their publishing house for whatever reason. Maybe there's something that's somewhat similar that's already on the list. Therefore, those two things will be competitive with each other. You know, there are a lot of factors that go into that decision. And I went out with a pitch for a middle grade manuscript that was totally different. It was a different series from the one I'm currently writing and that currently is being published. And the feedback I received from almost every editor who read it was, love this writing, love this humor, subject matter isn't right. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get rejected. And there are a lot of different reasons why that might happen. So, you know, I think it's important to glean whatever information you can from that feedback. If you're getting specific feedback, that's awesome. Use it. Use it to improve whatever it is you're doing, because it takes time for an editor to sit down and write something specific to everyone who she rejects. I try to do it as often as I can, because I think that information is only going to help me in the long run. Right. So it's so selfish on my part. No, I want to help, of course. I want to help guide people. But that is true, that if I'm only giving generic responses to why I don't want something, it's not going to help that agent find me the right thing. And it's not going to help that author understand, you know, what they maybe could do better. So, you know, that specific feedback does take a long time though to write, and it takes effort. So if you're getting that, it's coming from a really good place, and it's coming from a sincere place. So I would suggest absolutely taking it to heart and trying to see if you can go back and rework something. But I think also a really, really important piece of advice to always remember is that being a children's book author or illustrator doesn't mean having one project that you dream up one night and publishing that and then miraculously being a children's book author or illustrator.
Right.
That's not what it is, right? It's a lifestyle. It's a career. It's a choice to be in this field and to focus on this art style and to work really hard at getting it right, and knowing that you're not always going to get it right. Most of the time, you're not going to get it right, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, but you're in it because you love it and because this is what you want your life to be. It's not about one project. And most often, you're going to get rejected way before you get published, you know, and what gets published is probably going to be the thing that you didn't think about. And again, I can go back to even my own sort of personal experience, which is that on this middle grade project, this first one that I worked so hard on, and I pitched and I wrote and I rewrote and I, you know, polished, and it went out to so many people with an agent, and the feedback came back. But the editors who had received it at Scholastic, they said, hey, this subject matter isn't right for us, but we love this voice. We love Orly's writing. Get her in here. We'll have a meeting with her and let's figure out something that will work. And that's how Happily Ever After Life came to be. As I said, well, hey, I have this other idea. And this was an idea that I literally just thought about on the subway one day. I hadn't done anything with it. I hadn't fleshed anything out.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of pitched it offhand, like, there's this one other thing I could pitch you. And that's the thing that happened. And so, you know, a lot of times it works that way.
Well, I think that's a perfect place for us to wrap up. Thank you so much, Orly, for joining me on Stories Unbound today. It's been so fun talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And tell everyone where we can find you on the internet.
Okay. So I do have a website. You can find me at orlyzurovicki.com. I am also on Twitter and on Instagram and on Facebook, but my Twitter Instagram handle is Oz Said So. So you can find me there.
Cool.
Find me, follow me. I would love to connect.
Cool. Thank you again. It's been really fun talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Orly, for the fabulous interview, and I would love to have a discussion with you, dear listener. Today, Orly helped us understand what it's like to be an editor at a major publishing house. What did you learn about the editor's role that you didn't know before? Come to oatlyacademy.com/go/SU19 and tell us about it in the comments. Well, that about wraps it up for our episode today. But do you guys remember a long, long time ago, actually about a year ago, when I interviewed Jake Parker? Well, Jake Parker returns next time on Stories Unbound. As promised, Jake and I discuss what we did to promote our picture books and maybe give you guys a few ideas on what you can do to promote picture books. So join us next time for that. And until then, keep drawing and keep dreaming. Stories Unbound is a production of the Oatly Academy of Visual Storytelling. I'm your host, Shauna J.C. Tenney. Our producer is Chris Oatly. Our assistant producers are Anya Marcos and Edua Ebeneba. Our editor is Kevin Scarborough. Our mix engineer is Zijian Yan. Our theme music was provided by Ryan Keith and Wes Siepen. Subscribe at storiesunboundshow.com. Find more art and story podcasts featuring insights from some of the most inspiring voices in animation, games, VFX, comics, and children's books at friendsofstoriesunbound.com.